him, all things considered, so she said, thank you. And I also think if you're really serious about this as a career, then maybe this isn't the right thing for both of us. Maybe what isn't the right thing? Lucinda, please don't play dumb.
I'm not playing dumb, said Lucinda. I'm being dumb. Are you breaking up with me or firing me?
And Gavin laughed and said, oh, God, no. Lucinda relaxed a little and said, oh, okay.
You're not fired, no. This is just a breakup.
Lucinda quickly unrelaxed the little she had just relaxed and shouted, what?
Oh, please don't make a scene, said Gavin. I'm doing this because I care about you.
You're breaking up with me at work? Who does that?
But Lucinda knew who does that. The kind of person who doesn't want the woman he's breaking up with to make a scene does that.
This doesn't have to be ugly. The truth is, neither of us ever really understood what the other one was looking for.
Lucinda nodded and went back to her office and thought about how incredible it was that in one conversation, Gavin could break up with her and also not give her a promotion and also say, I owe you an apology, all without actually apologizing. But now, Lucinda was getting very good at not thinking about any of that. In fact, that night she had trouble sleeping because she was so consumed by not thinking. Lucinda woke up and it was Friday, and she couldn't believe how long it had taken to get her to Friday. Every day had felt incredibly long and yet also incredibly empty. The week had been an endless string of moments, each one packed, stuffed, overflowing with emptiness. At the end of the day, Debbie spilled into Lucinda's doorway.
Can I get you dinner?
She asked.
Not tonight, thanks. I'm heading out soon.
Debbie glanced up and down the hallway and then leaned farther into Lucinda's office.
Hey, can I talk to you about the cinnamon sugar blast oat cubes?
And Lucinda said, you know, I was hoping you would.
I guess that must have seemed pretty random. The truth is, I wanted to just get you a watch, but Kelly checks the receipts and I thought that would look bad. But I figured cinnamon sugar blast oat cubes is a food item, so technically it's okay.
Lucinda looked at the picture of the Free Minions wristwatch on the front of the box.
Why did you want to get me a watch, Debbie?
Well, sometimes I look at you when I'm walking by your office to conference room H, and you look at me?
No, not like in a creepy way. I just mean I see you.
Okay.
And I see you check your phone a lot, and every time you do, you make this angry face. I feel so bad it makes me want to come in and give you a hug, and I know that's inappropriate, but I thought, maybe if I got her a watch, she wouldn't have to check her phone so much.
Lucinda looked back at the box, then back at Debbie. She thought about how pure Debbie was, how young and unsullied. She thought about how sad it was that one day Debbie would fall in love with someone who would at first appreciate all that was special about her, but eventually learn how to take her for granted. She thought about how this person didn't deserve Debbie, this person who didn't know how rare it was to be loved by a person so tender.
You know, you're a lot better than the last receptionist we had.
Debbie blushed.
Oh, I'm just doing the best I can. Every morning I remind myself, Debbie, you're doing the best you can, and that's all you can do, and that's enough.
Lucinda realized this was maybe the longest conversation the two had ever shared.
I'm going to miss you around here when you ship off to law school, she said. Where are you applying?
Debbie laughed.
Oh, God, no, I'm not, I could never get into law school. I'm just happy to help out at a place like this. I think the work the guys do here is so important and good.
Just the guys?
I'm sorry, the women too. I didn't mean any offense.
Lucinda smiled.
I think you'd actually be a good lawyer. You're very observant. You should take the LSAT.
I have, said Debbie. 3 times.
Oh. It's okay, said Debbie. You know, I used to be super bummed, but the truth is, you can get over anything with enough time. That was the other part of the idea behind the watch, the first part being the thing about you not having to look at your phone. The other part was so that you could remember that time was passing. For most things, really, the only thing to do is just let there be time.
Well, thanks again, said Lucinda.
Debbie nodded. You know, I always thought I would be a lawyer, but I kind of live my life by the law of, hey, if it's not meant to be, you know?
Yeah, said Lucinda. I feel like I once wrote a memo on that law. Debbie laughed. You're really funny. Okay, Lucinda thought. So I'm funny. No, she thought. I'm really funny. I am above average funny. On Monday, Gavin swung by Lucinda's office to ask how she was doing on that memo about whether a ferret could be classified as a service animal in Colorado. And Lucinda said, I'm doing fine, thanks. And the truth was she was doing fine, which in the scheme of things was not as good as good, but loads better than bad. I like your watch, said Gavin. Minions. Yeah, said Lucinda. Minions. She returned her gaze to the computer screen and got back to work.
More of the You That You Already Are, read by Nicholas Gonzalez. Being a president of the United States is the easiest thing in the world, basically. The main thing is you gotta show up on time. I know this because one time I showed up like 3 minutes late, which is still technically on time, basically, and Mr. Gupta just about bites my head off. 6:15 means 6:15, he's like. And I'm like, I'm sorry, the traffic, which isn't even the real reason I'm late, but that's just what I say now, because one time when I was late at this Quiznos I worked at, I told my boss it was because of Ramona, and at first he was real nice about it, but I could tell it bummed him out. And then like a week later I got fired because he said my family situation was interfering with my job performance, which wasn't even true really, because I could still make a killer sub like nobody's business. But anyway, now when I'm late, I just say it's because of traffic. So then Mr. Gupta's like, if you can't make it a priority to be here on time, I'm sure I can find someone who will. And I want to be like, come on, man, I'm like 3 minutes late. But then I know he'd be like, and look at all this additional time we're wasting arguing about it. And sure, then I could be like, well, yeah, no one is forcing you to argue with me. You could just let it slide. But the main thing you got to know about Mr. Gupta is that Mr. Gupta is never going to let anything slide. So you're better off usually just cutting your losses, which I guess is also one of the things you got to know if you want to be a president. So instead, I'm just like, I'm very sorry, sir. It won't happen again. So then you go see Emeka at wardrobe to pick up your costume. You're supposed to show Emeka your park ID with your picture and your presidential number on it so she knows what suit to pull. But if you've been there more than like a day, Emeka knows who you are and she's getting your costume before you've even pulled out your wallet. You walk into the room and Emeka lights up and is like, well, if it isn't President Arthur. Technically, she's not supposed to say that because according to park policy, you're not really President Arthur until you put the costume on. Park policy is very specific on this point. I guess because one time Thomas Jefferson was going around town all like, I'm Thomas Jefferson, and trying to get free shit out of it, like milkshakes or whatever, and picking up girls, and when that got back to park management, Mr. Gupta got his ass chewed out by the guys at corporate, so then we all got our asses chewed out by Mr. Gupta. Anyway, Emeka's real friendly, and she's got great stories, even though they're never really about anything. I guess it's more the way she tells the stories. Like, the story could be Teddy Roosevelt lost a button, and Emeka had to sew on a new one. But from the way she tells it, you'd think it was the most interesting story in the world, full of twists and turns and heroes and villains. One time, Valerie took a double shift, because I guess Emeka had to go to a wedding. And when I walked into wardrobe and saw Valerie in the morning, that was probably the worst day of my life. Also, that was the day the doctor told us Ramona's sickness had spread to her bones, so it was definitely a real bad day. I'm not saying the two things are related necessarily, Valerie sitting in for Emeka and my sister's sickness spreading to her bones. All I know is I feel much better every morning when Emeka's there. Nothing against Valerie, I just like Emeka better. Anyway, after you get your costume from Emeka, you go into the changing room and put your big giant head on, and then ta-da, you're a president. Being Chester A. Arthur is like the easiest president to be. Because basically you just have to stand around outside the entrance to the Rutherford B. Hedge Maze, by the bridge to a better tomorrow, over the river of racial intolerance, and sometimes Lincoln walks by, and then people ask if you'll take their picture with Lincoln, and you're just like, sure, I'm Chester A. Arthur, I'm not doing anything. And, okay, some days it feels like what's even the point of being a president if you're just going to be Chester A. Arthur? Like, there's this other guy who started on the same day I did, and he gets to be Franklin Roosevelt, which is a doubly sweet gig, because first of all, everyone loves FDR. But the even sweeter part is you get to sit down all day, except for during the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue review, when at the end of your New Deal song you stand up for like 5 seconds and it's a huge fucking to-do. You get a round of applause just for standing up, and you don't even have to do a soft shoe routine like Calvin Coolidge does. But also, if you're FDR, the shitty part is you got to memorize all these facts about FDR, who was president for like 100 years just about, and people are always coming up to you asking questions like, what's the only thing we have to fear? And what do you have against the Japanese anyway? And if you get them even a little bit wrong, then some kid's jerk parent is going to complain to park management, and then you know Mr. Gupta is going to get all up in your ass about it, so all things being equal, I'd rather be Chester A. Arthur, honestly. Some days, Benjamin Harrison wanders by for a couple hours, which isn't so bad, because at least it's someone to talk to. Benjamin Harrison's an alright guy, so long as you don't get on the subject of this extra-large fuck doll he got on the internet. You would think that would be an easy topic to avoid, because how often do extra-large fuck dolls come up in everyday conversation? But Harrison spent like 800 bucks on this thing, and I guess the more money you spend on something, the more you want to talk about it, even if the thing is a big silicone woman that you have sex with. He's like, normally these things go for thousands of dollars, but I got mine cheap because I got it used. And I'm just like, cool, man. And he's like, yeah, some people think it's weird, but I don't think it's weird. It's just masturbating. Everybody does it. And I'm just like, yep. And he's like, if I told you you could have the best orgasm of your life for $800, wouldn't you take that deal? This question is totally bonkers to me, because I can't even picture having all of $800 at one time just lying around waiting for me to do something with it. Like, could you imagine being like, what should I do with this almost $1,000? I guess I could use it to pay for half a month of rent on the shitty apartment I share with my mom and my sister, or maybe I could find a pretty lady and take her out for a real dinner, like to a place with cloth napkins and everything. Or how about I upgrade to a better cable package with, like, those fancy movie stations so Ramona doesn't have to watch junky talk shows all day? Oh, wait, I know. Why don't I go online and see if I can't find a fake plastic woman for me to jack myself off into? I don't even know where I'd keep one of those things. Like, do you also have to buy a special closet for it? I don't have space for that shit. Harrison keeps his in the back of his van, but I guess if you're me, you just keep it in the living room? I'm sure Ramona would get a kick out of it. She'd give it a name like Noreen or some shit. And when I got home from work, she'd go, your new girlfriend Noreen and I had the grandest of days together. Did you know Noreen was a child tennis phenom before her stroke left her completely immobile? Fascinating woman. Elegant lady. And then Mom would pull me aside and say, you have to get rid of that thing. Ramona spent the whole day talking to it. She asked me to make it a cup of tea. And then I'd take it back to my bedroom and try to have sex with it. But instead, I'd keep thinking about how sad it was that she was a child tennis phenom who'd had a stroke. So, all things considered, it's probably better I don't get the extra-large fuck doll. But Benjamin Harrison isn't a bad guy 90% of the time. And sometimes he has interesting things to talk about. Like one time he saw the new X-Men movie, and then on Tuesday he told me the whole story, so I didn't have to pay to see it myself. That was pretty decent of him, and he didn't have to do that. He even acted out some of the fight scenes. He also always has good gossip about what's been going on around the park on account of him being a floater and all. So sometimes he can tell you shit like, a little kid peed all over James Monroe. That's hilarious, because first of all, if you knew James Monroe even a little bit, you'd be like, fuck that guy. But also because second of all, Founding Fathers Square is about as far as you can get from wardrobe. So you have to imagine Monroe having to walk all the way across the park covered in little kid piss. And just picturing that could be the highlight of your week pretty much. So whenever Harrison wants to talk about his extra-large fuck doll that he keeps in the back of his van, and I want to be like, dude, shut the fuck up, nobody cares. Instead, I'm just like, come on, man, there are kids here. And that usually does the trick. If any guest at the park wants to talk to you, which basically only happens if there's a long line to talk to one of the important presidents, there's really just two things you have to know about Chester A. Arthur. One, I became president when President Garfield pissed somebody off and got assassinated. And two, my primary achievement was the Pendleton Reform Act. Then if someone asks you what the Pendleton Reform Act was, you could probably jump off the ground and fly to Hollywood and kiss a supermodel on the mouth, because you are definitely in a dream right now, because literally no one ever asks a follow-up question about the Pendleton Reform Act. Then at the end of the day, you change out of your costume and you return it to Valerie in wardrobe, or sometimes Emeka. Valerie and Emeka switch shifts. I like seeing Emeka in the morning, because then it feels like it's going to be a good normal day with no surprises. But if Emeka and Valerie switch shifts and I see Emeka at the end of the day, that's not the worst thing in the world either, I guess. The only problem is I feel bad giving my sweaty costume to Emeka for her to clean, which is, I guess, the downside of Emeka working the night shift. I like to imagine Emeka coming into work in the morning and pulling my costume out of the dryer, clean and warm, maybe even holding her cheek up to Chester A. Arthur's chest to get a little of that warmth. Anyway, that's like a typical day, or it was before all the shit started going down. The shit starts on a Sunday, of course. Shit always starts on a Sunday. I guess because that's our last day, so if management wants to flip some switch that makes everything go all badass nutty, everyone can cool off over the weekend, which is what we call Monday. And then when we come back into work on Tuesday, it's like nothing ever happened. Anyway, I'm already in a bad way, on the day the shit starts going down. Because the night before, Ramona gets a bad reaction to her new medication, so I'm up all night, keeping her company while she throws up every 20 minutes. We try to make a game of it, where every time she barfs, I ask her a question about one of her favorite things. Hey, Ramona, what do you think of the new Drake album?
Barf.
Really? You used to love Drake. You don't like the new stuff?
Barf.
Wow, strong reaction. Guess I should delete all the Drake songs off your phone. Guess you hate Drake now. And Ramona smiles, even while barfing, and is like, you're so stupid. And I'm glad I could be there for Ramona and make her smile. But the end result is I'm real tired at work the next day, which is not the way you want to be when shit starts to go down. At this point, Van Buren's been on leave for about a week on account of him taking his wiener out and waving it at a bunch of deaf kids during the fireworks show. It's not that he's a pervert, he tried to explain. He just got confused between deaf kids and blind kids. I guess Mr. Gupta didn't go for that explanation because after a week, word trickles down that Van Buren's not coming back. And not just that Van Buren. Harrison says any Van Buren. I don't get it. I'm like, what, are we just not going to have a Van Buren? And Harrison's like, would you miss him? Next thing is Mr. Gupta's calling an all-presidents meeting after hours. This is serious business, an all-presidents meeting. Mostly news goes out in small groups, and by the time they call in my group's group 5, word's already spread anyway. Last time I can remember an all-presidents meeting was when Madison was racist to one of the guests. So Mr. Gupta called us all in at once so he could tell us, don't be racist. And Madison's like, but what if your guy really was racist? Like, what if he owned slaves? And Mr. Gupta's like, yeah, okay, but still, don't be racist. This time the meeting's about Van Buren. I'm sure you're all wondering why Van Buren isn't here, Mr. Gupta's like. And Franklin Pierce is like, because he showed his wiener to those deaf kids? And Mr. Gupta gets all flustered and is like, no, well, yes, but that's... He takes a moment to regain his composure. I'm sure you're all wondering why Thomas Jefferson isn't here, Mr. Gupta's like. I look around, I hadn't noticed, but sure enough, Jefferson isn't there. In fact, a lot of people aren't there. Mr. Gupta smiles and is all, I'm sure you're thinking, how are we going to open the park next week without Andrew Jackson, or James Monroe, or John Adams, or even George Washington? I look around. Yeah, pretty weird. Well, Mr. Gupta continues, what if I told you we could get 10 presidents for the manpower of one? And not just people pretending to be presidents, real, actual presidents. Just then, the door to the extra office where no one's allowed opens, and a white lady in a suit backs out into the bullpen holding a long chain. And she calls into the extra office like, come on. Come on, buddy. A low groan comes out of the extra office where no one's allowed, and Benjamin Harrison and I look at each other like, well, this is some shit, huh? The white lady looks at us and smiles, white lady Lee, and is just like, he's very shy. And Mr. Gupta's all annoyed now, like he called this whole meeting and everything, and now whatever's back there on the other side of that chain, which I guess was the whole point of it, won't even come out. And he's just like, is he coming out or not? And the lady ignores Mr. Gupta and just keeps looking into the room and is like, come on, buddy. And the low groan gets louder. And out comes this thing on a leash, a terrifying 10-foot-tall behemoth of a man, heaving with every breath, eyes bulging, lower jaw jutted, a gnarly ragdoll made of people stuffed into a half-button colonial outfit. And the room fills with gasps and, oh my gods, and what the shits? And the lady speaks over us and announces, please do not alarm him, he's very temperamental. And Mr. Gupta shouts out, quiet! Everyone will be quiet, please, for our guest. And Kennedy's like, what the hell is that thing? And the lady's like, it's not a what is that thing, it's a who is that thing. Mr. Gupta beams. You know, a lot of you have maybe forgotten how important President Land is. A lot of you think maybe this is all fun and games. But actually, President Land is a very educational place for families. A lot of respectable people think what we do here is very noble work. I look over at the large man thing. It's drooling and looking around like it's scanning the room for an exit. I work for Frank Fielding, says the white lady. And everyone just kind of looks at her like, who? And she says again, annoyed, Frank Fielding, the Frank and Felicity Fielding Foundation, funding tomorrow's solutions today for yesterday's problems tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, yeah, because I'm pretty sure I heard that in a commercial once. The lady's smiling super wide now. Frank Fielding is a true visionary and a game changer. Some people say he's like the new Steve Jobs, but I actually think he's more like Che Guevara meets Gandhi, if Che Guevara and Gandhi were billionaires. And Harding's like, it kind of sounds like you got a crush on Frank Fielding. And the lady's like, I do not have a crush on him because he is my boss, and besides, he has a wife, so that is impossible. Please ignore President Harding, Mr. Gupta coughs out. He is very rude. The lady continues, We at the Frank and Felicity Fielding Foundation think what you do here is so vital and necessary. After all, who are presidents if not the innovators and disruptors of history? And Hoover shouts out, "Who indeed?" And Hoover's idiot buddies start giggling. And Mr. Gupta's like, "Guys, please." The lady continues, "But why remember what history was when instead you can experience what history is? Through samples from their distant progeny, we at the Fielding Corp Research Labs were able to reconstruct with 88% accuracy literally up to 12% of the actual genetic makeup of the fathers of this nation. With that DNA data and the world's most powerful 4D printers, we were able to construct our tax-deductible gift to the park. Wajum Majvet. Say hello, Wajum." She yanks on the chain, and the beast groans a plaintive guttural wail. "Wajum Majvet is a perfect genetic combination of the first 10 presidents," Mr. Gupta announces proudly. "Wajum Majvet," the lady repeats. "Washington, Adams, Jefferson, the rest." And Mr. Gupta continues, "Not just guys in costumes. I'm saying this guy is the actual president's..." Oh no, he's vomiting. Sure enough, this thing is now puking all over the floor, like for real, just fire hosing chunks all over the place. And part of me wants to cut through the awkwardness by asking the monster what it thinks of the new Drake album, but I know I probably shouldn't in front of the white lady. She starts stroking his scraggly hair and says, "It's okay, this is natural. People do this, Wajum. This is natural." And Mr. Gupta's like, "Please ignore the vomiting. Once we get the vomiting under control, Wajum Majvet will be beloved by children and visitors to the park of all ages." And that's the end of the meeting. Tuesday morning, I ask Emeka at wardrobe if she's seen the new addition of the park. "Seen it?" she's like. "Who do you think made the costume for it?" I immediately feel stupid for asking. Of course Emeka would know all about it. What with wardrobe being so close to Mr. Gupta's office and right next to the extra office where no one's allowed. She zips up the back of my suit, and I'm like, "What do you make of it?" "I think it's kind of neat," she shrugs, "science and all." And I'm just like, "Yeah, I get that part of it, and I definitely do get that part of it, but I guess from where I'm sitting, it's like, maybe ease up a little, science, you know? It's like, where's the fire, science?" And she's like, "Yeah, no, I get that too. I like the eyes, though." "The eyes?" "Wajum's eyes. Did you see them?" And I have to confess, I did not spend a lot of time looking into the eyes of the puking monster. "They're soulful," she's like. "Those eyes have seen a lot. 10 presidents, right?" And I'm like, "That's what they say." And Emeka gets all thoughtful. 10 men in one body. I feel like there's a lot going on in there. I mean, when he's not vomiting. And I'm just like, "I guess it takes all kinds." And she gives me a quirky little smile and says, "Guess so." There's a thing I like about Emeka. It's that she sees stuff kind of crooked like that. Like to say that Wajum Majvet isn't just a monster, but 10 men in one body with real soulful eyes. It's funny, but also kind of sweet. I don't really get the science of it, so I don't know if that's how it actually is or not, but like I said, it's an interesting way to look at it. Benjamin Harrison swings by my post after lunch, and I tell him what Emeka said about Wajum being 10 men and all, and Harrison thinks that's pretty hilarious. "Look, man," he says, "I spent all morning at Founding Fathers Square, and let me tell you, that dude is barely doing the work of one man." And I'm like, "No." And he's like, "Dude's tied to a pole like a tetherball. He mostly just sits there jabbing the ground with a rock. Every once in a while, he blurts out a phrase like, 'The insurmountable folly of intransigence.' But mostly, he just kind of grunts and falls down." And I'm like, "Sounds like those scientists maybe got a little too much James Monroe in there." And Harrison's like, "Ha ha." Meanwhile, Ramona needs to go to the clinic to get the results of her blood work. And Mom wants me to come with in case the news is bad. It's on a Thursday, of course, which is the worst time to miss work on account of Thursday is a big day for field trips. I try to tell Mom things are weird over there. It's not a good time to ask for time off. And she's just like, "I'm sorry your sister picked a bad time to get sick. That was real selfish of her, huh?" And I'm like, "Why do I gotta go? If the news is bad, what difference does it make?" And Mom is like, "Ramona needs to know that you're there for her." And I'm like, "I'm there for her by going to the job that pays for our rent and covers her medical costs." And Mom is like, "Will you just ask?" So then, like an idiot, I'm sitting outside Mr. Gupta's office end of day Wednesday, waiting for him to finish up whatever meeting he's in. I'm sitting in one of those dinky chairs he's got in the waiting area right outside, and I'm hearing him shout through the walls, "People are asking, where's Washington? Where's Andrew Jackson? And they are not happy with your confounding simulacrum." And I hear the white lady say, "Okay, I acknowledge your feedback. And I am internalizing it. What I am hearing is we were too bold with our pilot program. Obviously, we're putting too much pressure on one hybrid to try to capture the magic of guys like Washington and Jackson and what have you. And Mr. Gupta's like, I mean, those are some of our most popular guys. Well, what if you hired back the original 10 and we gave you a new hybrid? One who replaced your least popular guys. That's low risk for you, and it gives us the chance to work out the kinks. And Mr. Gupta's like, honestly, I've soured on this whole cloning 10 presidents at once idea. Maybe we should just stick with the people in costumes. And the white lady's like, Mr. Gupta, I'm very surprised and disappointed to hear you say that. Do you not remember the agreement your boss has signed with Fielding Corp, giving us an ownership stake in the park so we could beta test new biotechnologies? I would hate to take you to court over this, especially because everyone at the foundation still believes so passionately in the mission of President Land and the potential of our work to make history come alive. And Mr. Gupta's like, please, no one needs to go to court. And the lady's like, I completely agree, so we're definitely on the same page there. Plus, we're on the same page as far as Wajum rollout being unfortunately premature. We all got a little excited, which is not a crime. This is why we try things. We need to allow ourselves to fail so that we can fail upward. We'll try again with different presidents, yes? And Mr. Gupta's like, we can try. And the lady's like, lower status presidents? And Mr. Gupta's like, yes. And the lady's like, marvelous. I knew you could be reasonable. Well, I might not be the sharpest commemorative butter knife in the presidential gift shop, but I am not a complete moron, so I know this isn't great news for old Chester A. Arthur. I duck across the hall into wardrobe, where Harrison is still getting out of his costume. I tell him the whole thing, and he's like, well, we're fucked. And I'm like, no, yeah? And he's like, look, man, I'm Benjamin Harrison, the less famous Harrison. Think about that for a second. I'm less notable than the guy who was only president for a month, and you're Chester A. Arthur. Your primary achievement was like the Peabody referendum or some bullshit. And I'm like, Pendleton Reform Act. Who gives a shit? We're bottom 10, easy, any way you measure it. If they're getting rid of 10 presidents, you're a goner, I'm a goner. When I get back home and Mom asks me what happened with the asking for time off, I just say it's a no-go. And she's like, what the hell does that mean, it's a no-go? And I'm like, sometimes things are no-goes, Mom. So now I'm figuring my days at the park are numbered. Don't get me wrong, this is a true bummer, because we for real need the money right now, but I'm not thinking I'll miss the park itself much. I certainly won't miss all the dipwad presidents who work here. When I was a kid, I used to come to President Land and dream of being a president one day. Like, that's how small and stupid my imagination was. I thought dressing up in a big suit and putting on a big foam head and acting all fancy at a theme park was like the height of importance and sophistication. The truth is, the whole place is just a bunch of assholes. And it turns out making an asshole a president just means you end up with an asshole president. Probably could have guessed that. Being president doesn't change you, not really. Just brings out more of the you that you already are. But I will miss Emeka in wardrobe. And maybe the idea of not seeing her every day is getting me sentimental, or maybe all the time in the suit in the hot sun is making me stupid, or maybe since I'm probably going to get canned soon, I just don't give a shit anymore in any direction. But whatever the reason, I decide to ask Emeka if she wants to get a drink sometime after work. As soon as I ask her, I regret it. Because first of all, of course she doesn't. And second of all, where am I going to take her? The only bar I ever go to is the one in the back of the bowling alley. You can't really take a girl there, because it's full of weird old guys who are all trying to sell you hand soap on account of this pyramid scheme that took certain pockets of the town by storm last year. I feel like if I tried to take Emeka to a nice bar, like a wine bar or an upscale club or something, the bouncer would take one look at me and be like, are you kidding me? And Emeka would look at me and be like, you know, I didn't see it before, but now that I think about it, this bouncer's got a point as far as the are you kidding me part. But then I forget all that because Emeka says I'd love to. So now I'm thinking, fuck the Pendleton Reform Act, because Chester A. Arthur's new primary achievement is getting Emeka from wardrobe to get a drink with him sometime after work. For the whole week, pretty much, I am floating on air. Like, even when Mom tells me the results from the clinic aren't so good, I can't help but be an optimist about it. I go into Ramona's room and I sit on the side of her bed and I'm like, clinics, what do they know, right? And Ramona laughs and coughs and is like, total quacks. I told Mom, no more medical advice from people who take 7 years to graduate college. Yeah, I'm like, bunch of slow pokes. Myself, I'm a cynic when it comes to clinics. Clinic cynic, Ramona rasps, and I can tell she's getting tired. So I say one more thing, which is, hey, the main thing is it's going to be okay. And she closes her eyes and says, yeah, it's going to be okay. Well, meanwhile, the date with Emeka goes south before it even begins. And of course it does. Because why did I think I ever deserved a thing to happen to me that was just wholly good? Look, she's like, just as we're sitting down, I need to say something right off the bat. I don't know why you asked me for drinks, and I don't want to be presumptuous, but I think I should tell you I'm kind of in love with someone. And I'm like, oh, cool, no, that's no problem. The someone you're in love with is me, right? And she looks all uncomfortable and is like, no, sorry. And I'm like, no, I got it. I was just making a joke. And she looks even more all uncomfortable and is like, oh, cool joke. And I'm like, well, this is going great. And she's like, I really do like you as a friend, though. And I was stoked you wanted to spend more time with me. And I'm like, well, good news is things won't be awkward for you at work after this, on account of I'm probably getting fired soon. And she's like, why do you figure that? I tell her what I heard about how Mr. Gupta and the white lady are going to bring back the first 10 guys and replace 10 other presidents with the new mega president, and what Harrison said about us both being doomed. And Emeka goes, but you can't lump yourself in with Benjamin Harrison. Of course Mr. Gupta would want to get rid of him. That guy's a dirtbag. He's always looking at my boobs from inside his big giant president head. How can you tell? Because the whole head tilts down. Why doesn't he just look with his eyes? I don't know. He's an idiot. What I'm saying is, you're not like that. You're a hard worker, and you've got a good attitude, mostly, which actually sets you apart from a lot of the other guys here. If it's my opinion, I think you should fight for it. But here I'm like, what's to fight for? If he's going to replace the bottom 10 guys, either that's me or it's not. There's nothing I can do. And Emeka's like, hold up, did you say bottom 10 guys? And I'm like, yeah. Emeka thinks for a second, then leans in close. Listen, she's like, I've been spending some time in the extra office where no one's allowed. And I'm like, no shit? And she's like, I know technically I'm not allowed in there. No one is, but I'm usually the first person at the park, other than Amir from security, and it's so peaceful in there. And I'm all, isn't that where the big guy lives? And she goes, I could probably get in trouble just for talking about it. But my point is, the white lady has kind of made it her office, and so she and Mr. Gupta have a lot of conversations in there. What kind of conversations? Well, I don't know. Like I said, I just go in there early in the morning, and then I leave before anyone else shows up. But they've got a big whiteboard in there with all the president's names on it. And they keep rearranging it, putting them in different orders. What's the order based on? I don't know, but Washington and Lincoln are always right at the top, 1 and 2. And the bottom keeps changing, but it's usually like Hayes, Pierce, Fillmore, that kind of thing. And me? Chester Arthur? Emeka frowns and then says, like I said, it keeps changing. So it's not set in stone who the bottom guys are. It's not like based on historical importance. Honestly, if I had to guess, I'd say it was based on merch sales. And so then I'm thinking, that's fucked up, because I just don't have that much merch to move. But then another part of me is like, well, there's a chance. So on the bus ride home, I'm doing the math in my head, like, okay, who's definitely staying? Definitely all the recent presidents. Everyone back to Franklin Roosevelt, if I'm being honest, because old-timers love getting their pictures taken with presidents they've lived through. And the first 10, there's no way they'd bring them all back just to fire them again, so that's already 24 people who are almost definitely not getting fired, and I haven't even gotten to Lincoln yet. I start to freak out, but then I realize that between Tyler and FDR, pretty much the only sure bets are Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt. Then there are guys like Grant and Coolidge, not guaranteed to stay, but definitely more likely than me. And if we're really being rigorous, we can probably throw Wilson in that category too. Hoover and Buchanan might squeak in just on account of how bad they were, and people love hearing about how Garfield and McKinley got shot. So that leaves only 11 presidents, including me. Could I be a bigger draw than 10 of them? I make a list and I run through them over and over. Polk, Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, A. Johnson, Hayes, Cleveland, B. Harrison, Taft, Harding. These are the guys I've got to beat. Tough, but definitely doable. Most of them probably don't even realize they're on the chopping block. And if any of them do, they might figure, like Harrison did, well, what's the point in trying if I'm already getting sacked? Next day, I show up on time and ready to work. From my angle on things, I'm thinking I need a 3-pronged approach here. The first prong is all about projecting an air of professionalism and respect in front of Mr. Gupta. Good morning, Mr. Gupta, I'm like. It's a beautiful day to educate our guests about presidential history, I'm like. The second prong is about driving up interest in Chester A. Arthur with park visitors. There's only so much I can do on this front because most people aren't starting their day thinking, boy, I can't wait to meet Chet Arthur and possibly buy some Chet Arthur-related merchandise. But the truth is, I can leverage what I know about how the park functions to my advantage here. Like, for example, Teddy Roosevelt is always complaining that he gets slammed in the afternoons right around 1 because that's when Minnie Rushmore opens. But Lincoln doesn't show up until after the Emancipation Celebration. And now that Washington and Jefferson have been replaced by a barely sentient, drooling man-wall who needs to remain tied to his post for the safety of the children, well, it creates a lot of work for Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt already sort of likes me, as it happens, because one time he saw me riding my bike to work before it got stolen, and then for like a week, whenever he saw me on the other side of the bridge to a better tomorrow, he would shout, "Hey, bike!" And I'd be like, "Yeah, you said it." So it isn't hard to start a conversation with him now where I'm like, "Hey man, I think I can help with your 1 o'clock crunch. I'm barely doing anything at one. Like, my area completely empties out, so if you send people my way, I can totally handle them." And he's like, "Sure, but how am I gonna do that?" Here's what you gotta do. You gotta tell people. Used to be only way to get ahead in politics was through crooked dealings. Myself, I'm a mad respectable individual, but I never would have been president if not for the Pendleton Reform Act. And when people say, "What's the Pendleton Reform Act?" you say, "Why don't you go ask Chester A. Arthur?" And he's like, "Is that true? About me not being president if not for the whatever, whatever act you just said?" And I'm like, "Look, man, there's no way to know for sure what would have happened without the Pendleton Reform Act. Time is a mini-forked river that flows in one direction only. But we do know that there was a Reform Act passed, and then years later you became president. And I don't think it's a stretch to say those two things are definitely related." And he's like, "All right, well, at this point I'll try anything." "Great. So say all that, and then if people are still on the fence, you can say, "Perhaps no one changed the course of U.S. presidential history more than Chester A. Arthur." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not going to say that." And I'm like, "Yeah, that part's too much, but the rest of it?" And he's like, "Yeah, the rest of it, fine." The third prong of my plan, and this is the prong I feel not so hot about, is throwing some of those other guys under the bus. We have these anonymous "Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You" cards that we're supposed to fill out to report other employees when we witness violations of park policy. Everyone treats them like a big joke. But the truth is, there are a lot of violations that happen every day. Like, for example, everyone knows Hayes is vaping in the park, even though the park has a strict no vaping policy. I fill out an "Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You" card about Hayes vaping. And that night, Mr. Gupta calls him into his office. I feel gross about this on the one hand because, like, is Hayes really hurting anybody by sneaking vapes? And is Pierce really hurting anyone through his repeated use of anachronistic references, which I also write a card about? Or what about Fillmore letting three kids go at once on Fillmore's flume, even though Fillmore's flume is expressly designed to be enjoyed by two friends of Fillmore at a time? But on the other hand, park policy is clear, and it's every man for himself out there, and I'm not just looking out for me at this point. I've got people depending on me. And if other presidents are going to leave themselves vulnerable by making stupid mistakes, then maybe they don't deserve to be presidents in the first place. The one guy I don't write up is Benjamin Harrison, even though he definitely breaks park policy all the time. Like when I see him talk to guests about his sword collection, and it's unclear if actual Benjamin Harrison had a sword collection or if he's just talking about himself. But he's always been regular decent to me. And I feel like loyalty has to be good for something in this cutthroat world, because otherwise, what are we even doing? So like after a week of my three-prong approach, Mr. Gupta calls me into his office. "I've been really impressed by how you've been performing lately," he's like. And I'm like, "Just doing my job." And he's like, "The guys at corporate are really impressed too. There's been an uptick in sales of Arthur merch. I want you to know that the right people are noticing." And I'm like, "That's really great to hear, sir. You treat me with respect," he's like. "You treat this job with respect. Not everybody does that." And I'm like, "No." He's like, "I know everyone wants to have a good time, but this is a job, and people need to recognize that." "Oh, totally. That's always been my thing, 100%, it being a job and all. It's not like I like being the bad guy," he goes. "I know everyone thinks I'm a hard ass, but I'm getting pressure from all sides, you know." And I go, "Yeah, no, I know what you mean." And he goes, "Okay, well, keep it up." On the bus ride home, I think about Mr. Gupta for the first time, not just as a boss, but also as a person who exists and has feelings. I wonder if when he was hired to run the park, he realized what a bunch of assholes all the presidents were going to be. I know that by doing a good job, I'm making his life easier, and even though making Mr. Gupta's life easier is not why I do a good job, I'm not mad at that part of it. It also feels nice to know that my efforts have been noticed, because so much of the time, the lesson of life is that everything's built on bullshit and nothing you do matters. It's cool to feel like I have some control over my own destiny for once. Especially because Ramona's condition's taken a turn for the worse and she has to spend a couple days in the hospital for observation and possibly another surgery. The next day I feel motivated to go in early, just to keep up my streak of going above and beyond. And also because without Ramona in the apartment, it turns out my apartment is a real bummer. I catch the first bus before it even gets light out, and when I show up at the park, the only people there are Amir and security and Emeka. "You're here early," she's like. And I'm like, "Yeah, sorry, I know you like to be alone in the mornings." And she's like, "This is perfect, actually, because I want you to meet someone. Remember when I told you I was in love?" And now I'm really regretting coming in early because I can already tell this is going to be a whole thing. She takes me to the extra office where no one's allowed, and I'm like, "Emeka, I'm pretty sure we're not supposed to be back here." And she's like, "It's fine. No one will know. I do this every day." In the corner, chained to a wall, is Wajim Majvet, glaring menacingly, breathing heavily. "Hi, baby," Emeka's like, and Wajim Majvet continues to do his thing, which is sitting on the ground chained to the wall, glaring menacingly and breathing heavily. I'm like, "This is the guy you're in love with?" Emeka smiles. "You see it, right?" Wajim grunts. "Prolonged conflagration! Self-evident! Abigail!" He curls into a squat and starts whittling a stick. And I'm like, "Don't take this the wrong way, and I'm not always the best judge of character, but he kind of seems like a wild monster." "He's not a monster. I love him. I feed him whole onions that he eats like an apple." And now I'm thinking, if this is the kind of guy Emeka's into, then I never really stood a chance with her. And Emeka's like, "I know it's hard to understand. I was afraid of him at first, too, but he's really a gentle soul, and he has the heart of 10 men. Isn't that right, Wajim?" Wajim looks up at us and grunts. "Abuse of liberty is the bone and sinew, Abigail!" Emeka goes, "That's right, Wajim." And I go, "You know, we're really not supposed to be in this room. We could get in big trouble." And for some reason, Emeka starts crying and is like, "He knows he doesn't belong here, but it's not his fault he exists. He's not the one who made him in a lab." And the most fucked up part is now I love Emeka more than ever. Seeing how worked up she gets over this other guy who isn't even really a guy hardly as much as a weird, deformed, historical mishmash. I want to hold her and stroke her hair and tell her everything's going to be okay. But we are at work after all, and the park staff behavioral guidelines are very clear on appropriate and inappropriate touch ever since Eisenhower goosed the girl at the deep-fried Oreo stand. "Just do me a favor," Emeka's like. "Look into his eyes and tell me you don't see what I see." I look into his eyes and I see love. I see hate and anger. I see revolution and honor and dishonor all at once. And I go, "Okay, yeah, he seems like a cool guy." He vomits into a bucket. "I'm scared," she's like. "The white lady keeps talking about this new mega president they're building. Bigger, smarter, better. When that new guy's ready, what's going to happen to Wajim?" And I'm like, "I'm sure there's a plan." And she's like, "Yeah, the plan is they're going to kill him." "You don't know that." She starts shaking. "I do know that. They're going to kill him. We need to do something. We can't just let them..." And seeing her all agitated like that is making the monster agitated, and he starts shaking and growling menacingly, and I'm like, "Emeka, you need to calm down." I take a step toward her, and Wajim full-on freaks out, roaring and yanking on his chain, face all red. "Tyranny and oppression, Abigail!" He's like, "What the fuck?" I'm like. Emeka goes, "It's okay, Wajim. Shh, it's okay. I'm safe. You're safe." And Wajim whimpers softly. "See," Emeka says, "he wants to protect me. That's what love is. And we need to protect him." And I'm like, "Why we? I got enough problems just trying to hold on to my job. Why do I have to be involved with this part of it?" And she's like, "Because you have a good heart." And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't know about that. I definitely don't have the heart of 10 men. And she goes, "No, but maybe 2 or 3 men. And she smiles through her tears, and I think, "How can I say no to that face?" "You look really beautiful," I'm like. I cringe as soon as I say it, because "you look really beautiful" is one of the things you're not supposed to say to your coworkers as outlined in the park staff behavioral guidelines. And also, just in general, it's a pretty dumb thing to say to a girl as she's telling you how much she loves another man. No, 10 men in one man's body. But Emeka smiles at me and she's like, "Of course I do. I'm in love." So I'm like, "Well, let's see what happens, but just in the meantime, don't do anything crazy, right?" And she's like, "Yeah, no, of course." Mr. Gupta calls me into his office during my lunch break. White lady from the Frank and Felicity Fielding Foundation is there too, all smiles. "This is good news," he's like. "We're very happy with the work you've been doing with Chester A. Arthur." And I'm like, "That is good news, thank you." And he's like, "Yeah, but we're discontinuing the character." "What? Why? How are people going to learn about the Pendleton Reform Act?" And the white lady smiles and says, Fielding Corp is building a new hybrid president. We're about a week away from completion. Mr. Gupta goes, when the new hybrid comes in, we're going to transition you to a new role. We were thinking, Jimmy Carter? So now I'm thinking, hot shit, I've hit the big time. But also, I did not realize that the new president monster was going to be done so quickly. That is not great for the current president monster and any women who happen to be in love with him. And Mr. Gupta's like, by the way, please don't tell anyone about the conversation we had in here. This information is obviously very delicate. And I'm like, oh, totally, yeah. That night I go to visit Ramona in the hospital and I tell her the whole story. I feel like Emeka's about to do something rash, I'm like, but her heart is so pure and good. And Ramona's like, yeah, I don't know, this chick sounds crazy. I think you just got the hots for her. And I'm like, maybe, but what if she's right and Wajum's in real danger? And Ramona's like, yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Okay, do what the hot chick says. But on the other hand, Mr. Gupta's a good guy too. And it feels shitty to lie to him, especially since now he's given me this promotion. And Ramona goes, yeah, this is what the guy at the deli counter calls a real pickle. Oh, I know what you should do. What? And she goes, just think, who's your guy again? And I go, well, Chester A. Arthur for now, but next week they're moving me over to Jimmy Carter. And she goes, wow, okay, so just think, what would Chester A. Arthur and or Jimmy Carter do? How the fuck should I know? They never had to deal with this bullshit. Okay, I'm going to go to sleep. I think they're going to do surgery on me again in the morning. And I'm like, again? Why? And she's like, I don't know, I've lost track. Maybe last time one of the surgeons left her engagement ring inside me, so now she's hoping to get it back. Anyway, let me know how your thing all shakes out, okay? I think about Ramona's advice. The truth is, if Chester A. Arthur ever found himself in this situation, I think he would probably suck up to the higher authority and tell Mr. Gupta that Emeka's been having a secret affair with the mutant creature chained up in the white lady's office. Chester A. Arthur was always doing shit like that. I mean, not exactly like that, but similar. On the other hand, Jimmy Carter seems like a softie, and I feel like he would probably protect his friend's secret. So I guess if I'm going to be Jimmy Carter, I should probably do it the Jimmy Carter way. Next day, I show up to work and the police are there. What's going on? I'm like. And Benjamin Harrison's like, Wajum flew the coop. And I'm like, no shit? Harrison goes, Amir showed up this morning and Miguel was totally out of it. They think he got roofied. The whole thing's pretty hilarious. Why is it hilarious? I'm like. And he's all, because the park was working good before all these big money tech people started playing God? Serves them right. You can't replace real people with artificial people. And I'm all, tell that to your extra large fuck doll. And he goes, that's a completely different thing and you know it. Everyone gets called in for meetings with Mr. Gupta and the white lady one at a time. You know anything Mr. Gupta's like? And I'm like, I never know anything about anything. The white lady leans in like, you understand that was company property, right? That hybrid is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm like, really got your money's worth, huh? And Mr. Gupta's like, all right, well, if you hear something, you'll let us know. And I'm like, yeah, of course. I head out of Mr. Gupta's office and turn right into wardrobe. Emeka's in there, smiling tightly while the police go through her things. Hey, can I talk to you for a minute? I'm like. And Emeka's like, not right now, no. Maybe like outside for a minute I could talk to you? I'm like. And Emeka's like, really not a good time, but I'd love to talk later. Just then my phone rings. It's Mom. I step outside and answer. Where the hell are you? She's like. I'm at work, Mom. I'm in the middle of... Okay, well, I just wanted to call because your sister's going into surgery today and you don't even care. I do care, Mom. I care a lot. But she's not done talking. You don't care about your sister's cancer, she's like. And I'm like, don't say that. Don't say that word. What word? Cancer? That's what she's got. You know that, right? Yeah, Mom, I know, but Ramona's sickness is like the sun, okay? I can't look directly at it. And she's like, well, you need to look directly at it because she could die. And I go, she's not going to die, Mom. The doctors know what they're doing. She could die, Mom continues. And you're going to live the rest of your life knowing that you couldn't be there because you had to work. And I go, why do you say work like that? Work. It's not work. It's work, okay? It's my job. I can't not go to work. Things are very precarious right now. I am dealing with situations that you can't even... Your sister is going into surgery and she is very scared. And I'm like, you want to get a job? Because if not, who's going to pay for this surgery? And she's like, you know I can't work on account of my shaky hands. And I go, I know, Mom. Could you put Ramona on, please? I wander into the midway and linger by the McKinley shooting gallery. Ramona takes the phone and goes, I wish you were here. Mom is being so crazy. And I go, I wish I was there too. How are you doing? Mom says you're scared. And Ramona goes, nah, you know Mom likes to freak out. I'm gonna be fine. And I'm like, that's what I told her. And I hear Mom on the other side, you think you're invincible. You don't understand how serious this is. And I'm like, what, is she trying to scare you? And Ramona laughs and is like, yeah, Mom, why are you trying to scare me? I make eye contact with Amir from security across the midway, and he starts heading over. And I'm like, look, I gotta go, but I love you, okay? And Ramona goes, yeah, yeah, I know. I hang up the phone, and I'm like, hey, Amir, crazy stuff, right? Wow. And he's like, you were here pretty early yesterday. And I go, Amir, I don't know what you're thinking. And he cuts me off. Hey, man, the monster was there when I left work yesterday, and gone when I showed up today. What happens on Miguel's shift is not my problem, and I'm not looking to stir shit for no reason. And I'm like, I don't want to stir shit either, man. Like, that's my number one thing, is don't stir shit. And Amir's like, uh-huh. I'm just saying, because you've always been a good guy to me, and I don't know what kind of crazy you're mixed up with now. But if they don't get any leads off of these interviews, they're going to crack open that security footage, and then they're going to know who's been going in what rooms. And I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah. So I'm just thinking, if I'm you, maybe I'd want to get ahead of things and rat out the real troublemaker while the ratting out's good. Word trickles down that the park's going to open as usual, while the police continue the investigation, so we should all get into wardrobe and to our starting locations. I plant myself near the bridge to a better tomorrow, but I have trouble focusing. I text Emeka, what the fuck is going on? And she texts back, I swear I have no idea. Cops are still roaming the grounds, but so as not to alarm the guests, Mr. Gupta's put them all in costumes. Wardrobe's got these extra suits on account of the park always preps an alternate on election years in case the other guy wins. So now, suddenly, we've got guys like Dole and Dukakis and Romney silently drifting through the park like ghosts. At one point, a family comes over to take their picture with me. Dad goes, very excited. We were told we should come talk to you about the Pendleton Reform Act. I have no idea what he's talking about. At lunch, I get a text message from my mom. It says, get here now. I call her, but she doesn't pick up. I call again, but she doesn't pick up. I sneak out of the park, stashing my costume and giant Chester A. Arthur head behind some bushes near the entrance to the Trail of Tears tram, and snag the next bus to the hospital, where I meet a doctor outside Ramona's room. I'm like, what's going on? Doctor's like, well, what we've got is a classic good news, bad news situation here. The surgery was a success, but now she's not waking up. And I'm like, what do you mean she's not waking up? What are you saying? She's dead? No, not dead. No, she's just comatose. You put her in a coma? Yes, but we believe we've rooted out the source of her symptoms, so if she wakes up, she's all good. And I'm like, if? Then he says a whole bunch of big doctor words that I don't understand and shows me some charts and x-rays and ends the whole thing by saying, as I said, the surgery was a success. But she's in a coma, I'm like. And he's like, yes. If my sister's in a coma, I'd say the surgery was not a fucking success, was it? He's like, I can see you're very upset. We are monitoring your sister's condition and we will keep you informed of any. Just then his phone rings and he's like, I'm sorry, I have to take this. My daughter's finding out what colleges she got into. It's a very exciting time. He answers his phone like, hello? Princeton! Oh, that's incredible! And walks away. I knock on the door and Mom slips into the hallway. I'm like, what the hell are you thinking, not answering your phone? And she's like, where were you? You should have been here. Oh, you think if I was here, the doctors would have said, oh, let's not put her in a coma? You think I was the missing ingredient? And she's like, you're right, I'm stupid. It's good that you never show up. And I go, I'm sorry, Mom, okay? You're right. I'm sorry. Did the doctors tell you anything else? No, there's no news. No one will talk to me. Well, you'll let me know if anything changes, right? And she's like, come into the room. Sit down. I can't go in there. I'm like, I can't see her like that. When she wakes up, I'll come back. And Mom's like, what if she doesn't wake up? What if she dies? And I'm like, well, if she dies, then it doesn't make a difference if I see her now or if I see her when she's dead, right? And Mom's like, what is wrong with you? And I'm like, I gotta go back to work, Mom. I try to sneak back into the park, but Mr. Gupta spots me. Where the hell have you been? He's like. And I'm like, I'm sorry, my sister. And he's like, this is not a good day, you understand. Wajah Majved is still missing, so this is not the time to make it look like I can't keep track of my presidents. And I go, look, the thing about Wajum is he's a 10-foot-tall stitched-up clone mutant made of presidents. I feel like he's going to turn up. Maybe everyone doesn't need to be freaking out so much. This is not life or death. It is life or death, Mr. Gupta's like. I'm going to get fired over this. I put everything into this park. I have a family. You must understand that. If you know something, anything at all, please tell me. And I'm like, look, man, nobody tells me anything around here. I'm barely back in position by the bridge to a better tomorrow when I see a man with an unfamiliar big giant head on the other side of the river gesturing for me to come over. I think it's Al Gore. I gesture back like, who, me? And he gestures like, yeah, get over here. I hustle over to him and I'm thinking, fuck, now I gotta answer a bunch of questions for the police? And this is probably going to go on some sort of permanent criminal record. And my mom's gonna drop a heavy shit when she finds out. And I should be calling a lawyer for this because I do not know any lawyers and this is definitely not what I signed up for when I applied to be a president. But Al Gore doesn't say anything. Instead, he indicates that I should follow him and he starts walking. He takes me to the Panama Canal, an indoor river ride that got boarded up 5 years ago on account of some of the animatronics turned out to be culturally insensitive. We slip in a back entrance, and in the dark, nestled in shrubbery, I can make out the outline of a sleeping Wajum Majvet, and I hear him muttering in his sleep, duplicity, yams. I turn to Al Gore, and I'm like, listen, man, I don't know how this guy got in here. I've got nothing to do with this. Al Gore takes off his big giant Al Gore head. It's Emeka. What the fuck? I'm like, why did you text me and say you didn't know where he was? Emeka's like, you don't think they're tracking our phones? Look, this is deep shit now, okay? Wajum is very valuable property. He's not property, okay? You can't own a person. I explode. Most of Wajum owned people. She rolls her eyes and goes, that was like 200 years ago. And I go, there are security cameras all over this place. We are both going to be in a hard fuckload of trouble, like any minute now. Emeka shakes her head. Those things don't work. They're just there to scare you. How do you know that? Because I've been in the security office. The only monitors they got are connected to cameras at the entrances and exits to the park, which is why we haven't left the park yet. It's not too late, I'm like. If you came clean to Mr. Gupta now, if he got to be the one to return Wajum to the guys at Fielding Corp, and Emeka shouts, Wajum is not going back to Fielding Corp. And Wajum rouses from his slumber and roars a mighty Wajum roar. And I'm like, hey, shh, keep it the fuck down. How long do you think you can keep this guy a secret here? And Emeka's like, well, I was hoping you could help me. You have a van, right? And I'm like, no, I don't have a van. And she's like, I thought you had a van. And I'm like, no, man, I take the bus. She's like, why did I think you had a van? And I'm like, I don't understand why you think any of the things you think. But then it hits me, and I immediately hate myself for saying out loud, Harrison has a van. Emeka's eyes go wide. Which Harrison? Benjamin Harrison. It's where he keeps his fuck doll. And she's like, oh my God, will you talk to him for me? I need that van. Why don't you talk to him yourself? I'm not friends with him like you are. Please, President Arthur, will you talk to Benjamin Harrison for me? It's never occurred to me before, but I think Emeka doesn't even know my real name. And I go, yeah, I'll connect you to Harrison, but just from now on, leave me out of it, okay? I don't want to have anything to do with your plans. I don't want to know about them. I'm not involved, okay? And she goes, yeah, just help me get that van, and I will never bother you with this again. So I talk to Harrison, and at first he's like, why should I help her out? That stuck-up bitch has always treated me like I'm a weirdo, and now she wants my fuck doll wagon? Well, who's the weirdo now? And I'm like, just think of it like you're in an X-Men movie, and Wajum is the mutant who's being persecuted, and you're the X-Men, and he needs you to save him. And Harrison considers this and then goes, okay, but after we put him in my van, what's the next part of the plan? And I'm like, I don't know. Talk to Emeka. I don't want to have anything to do with it. And he's like, is she going to need me to bring my swords? I go back to my post and just try to be Chester A. Arthur for a little bit. I think about how no matter which way this all breaks, this is probably one of the last times I'm ever going to be Chester A. Arthur. And honestly, it feels kind of bittersweet. I think about how shitty the real President Arthur must have felt at the convention when, after the Pendleton Reform Act, his own party wouldn't even nominate him for re-election. I feel kind of bad for abandoning President Arthur, just like everybody else. But also, I feel more and more like, in the world of politics, you've got to look out for yourself, because it's not like anyone else is going to be looking out for you. Suddenly, there's a large crash from the other side of the park and the screeching of van wheels. Possibly gunfire? A crowd runs past me, but I stay planted at the bridge to a better tomorrow because of, like I said earlier, looking out for myself and all. I get a call from Emeka and I ignore it. I get a call from Harrison and I ignore it. After all, you're not supposed to use your phone in costume. Park policy. A few minutes later, Buchanan ambles by and says, "Hey man, Mr. Gupta wants to see you in his office. White lady too." I start to head over, but then I think, this is stupid. So I leave. I take a bus to the hospital and I turn my phone off. I leave my phone off for days and I sit with Ramona while she sleeps.